Thank you for choosing this Analyst Insight podcast from the Information Security Forum. My name is Mark Ward, and this is the second of a series of podcasts that we're doing about Threat Horizon 2024. That's the latest edition of the annual report the ISEP produces that considers the dangers, issues, innovations that are going to be troubling InfoSec teams over the next few years. With me today is Paul Watts, who was a CISO for 16 years before joining the ISF as a distinguished analyst.
Hello.
Thank you, Paul. And also here is Richard Absalom, a principal analyst at the ISF, who was instrumental in helping Paul and myself put the Threat Horizon report together and is a veteran of several of those reports. Hello, everybody.
Hi, Mark. Thanks.
I wouldn't describe Richard as a veteran. He's very useful.
I'd still say grizzled, though. Grizzled through 6 years of Threat Horizon reports.
6 years, woo! Yeah, there's a wise old head on those young shoulders, perhaps. Maybe that's the best way to put it.
Oh, nicely put, nicely put.
We'll take that.
So, in this podcast, what we're going to talk about is the themes that run through the report. And before we dive into those, I want us to talk about the backdrop to the whole report. Because for every one we produce, there's typically a moment in time or a sort of particular zeitgeist, if you want, that we try to capture, which is the sort of that emerges while we're doing the research, while we're talking to people, looking into some of the issues that are going to emerge. And this year, that bigger backdrop that out of which all the other threats emerge is something we call the disintegration of trust, very ably captured in the cover for the report as well. And the reason that we chose that was because we certainly thought that as we were writing the threats, just considering what the world's going to be like in a couple of years, there does seem to have been a significant change in that trust, in the sense we are using it, is that unifying force, that faith that things are reliable, that business will continue, that some stability out there, and that you can trust on your suppliers to be to operate in the same kinds of ways, that data is what it seems to be, and that your training conditions will continue. Our growing sense through while writing that report was that's no longer the case, and certainly by 2024, you just will not be able to have any kind of faith in the regularity, stability, those business as usual, whatever that means, type situation. Richard, Paul, does that capture that broader idea, that backdrop, that shadow out of which everything emerges? Is that a good enough summary?
Yeah, I think so. And I think what was interesting this year was that theme that kind of brought everything together and all the threats that you guys have been investigating and talking to members about and kind of, gathering in, emerged really early. So I've got to say, I think it emerged earlier this year than we've probably seen in previous versions where we try and find something that links everything together. And there was a pretty obvious, kind of theme from early on that, this idea of trust that holds the fabric of society as much as the ability to do business to hold it all together is definitely starting to crumble. It's been pushed and prodded from all sides these days, so to say that by 2024 things are going to be even worse, just not being able to know whether to trust what you see in front of you, whether the tech vendors that you work with are trustworthy, anyone, I think that's going to be under question.
Well, we've proven it, haven't we? I mean, we've just come through a pandemic, an event I hope I never have to go through again, and we have seen the power that data and information has over society, and we're generating so much of that data and information, and we're consuming it much more rapidly and quicker, that the ability to validate and verify, it just doesn't necessarily exist, so we take a lot for granted. But that's a fantastic opportunity, and fantastic's probably the wrong word to use, for exploitation. I mean, we mentioned in the summary the idea that we thought we were in control of data and it was all about the exploitation of big data. I think the reality is, we carry on the way that we are, the data is going to control us. And there are multiple opportunities for that to be exploited. So, you're right. We did come to, we thought we were onto something very, very early on. And the more we dug, the more we found the broader spectrum of topics that we then go on to talk about in the report, Mark.
Yeah, I think so, because there are two sides to this. I think one is that in some respects, it's a sign of maturity. I think because if you no longer trust your data, perhaps that's a good thing. Maybe you trusted it too much. And I think there's been a certain amount of that. And like you say, some of the bad guys, some of the threats we write about do trade on that assumption that people do trust what they're told. And now, unfortunately, yeah, we're all maybe more suspicious for all kinds of reasons, some good, some bad. But I think, yeah, I mean, that's definitely, I think, as to your point as well, Richard, yeah, it's not just for InfoSec that this has changed. I think globally as well, there's some bigger changes have gone on that we definitely needed to acknowledge here.
Yeah, and of course, I always like that point of view from Threat Horizon. We have to, you know, couch it in terms of what the world in general is looking like. That's why we do that piece at the beginning of the report, looking at, you know, where the world's going in terms of political, environmental, social, technical, you know, point of view. Because, yeah, obviously the threats we talk about have a much wider impact than just upsetting some folks in the InfoSec team.
Yeah, and again, another sign of maturity, I think, that InfoSec teams are expected to have an opinion about those things and could have some, you know, do have useful skills that can be brought to bear on those. I think that, you know, that inclusion in the broader strategy of the business as well, I think is important as well. And I think the last couple of reports we've produced have definitely acknowledged that, sort of that stepping up by InfoSec teams and practitioners, just as, you know, what they're likely to be asked about and talk about. But I think just to quickly move on to our first big theme for the report, which has the title, Well-Intentioned Regulations Have Unintended Consequences. And we've done a couple of webinars about the report, and as one of the comments in the webinar said, well, hasn't that always been the case, that regulators rarely get it right? And I think that's true, but I think it's just got worse. I think there's just to your point, Paul, about the amount of data out there and you know, what organizations are doing with it and what regulators are trying to stop them doing with it or would like them to do with it. That's where everyone's being caught out.
Yeah, I think the difference that we have now is the speed in which everything is happening, the speed of innovation, technically, non-technically, the speed of the creation of the data economy. You know, 175 zettabytes by 2025 is just an astounding amount of data and of information. And, you know, this has been a problem for lawlords and regulators for a long, long time. I remember very early on, back in the mid-80s, the case of Robert Schifrin and Steve Gould, the notorious Prince Philip Prestel hack of 1984. And what was interesting with that one was the legislators struggling to find the right laws to punish, because the reality was there wasn't anything. And in the end, I think they were prosecuted on a very minor misdemeanor to do with the use of a tool for fraudulent purposes or some BS like that. And anyway, you kind of fast forward, Computer Misuse Act of 1990 came to pass. And we find ourselves complaining about that even now, you know, that act is not fit for purpose. But as quickly as we bring that up to date, the world would have moved on again. You know, you pivot that into some of the conversations we have in the report about the regulation of algorithms and artificial intelligence. The same thing occurs, but because of the way that the world operates now, you've got a balance between legislating against moral and ethical and wrongs. You know, to get that balance of risk and reward right, but you also have geopolitics over the top of that as well now. So legislation that might be applicable in one region isn't applicable in another. Completely changes the dynamic of what you're trying to do. So it's a real melting pot of challenges that they have to keep up with in this day and age.
Yeah, I think so. I think certainly organisations have outrun regulations in all kinds of ways, because a lot of them are quite fleet-footed. They're quite fast-moving. They're trying to do things fast, and they recognise they need to. But I think often those regulators, those laws, those guidelines just don't fit what they're trying to do with them, and you know, and there's some very difficult conversations as a result. But I think as well that sense as well that regulation is changing too, and that there is a recognition by the regulators that there is real harm here as well, and that's what they want to try and curb. But again, like you say, in different places, harm is viewed in different ways, and that makes it very difficult for any large organisation to get this right everywhere.
That harm wears different hats, doesn't it? So you can talk about the harm that legislation brings to, you know, the desired outcomes. The harm also is brought to organisations on the bleeding edge. So if you're an organisation that's really trying to ride the crest of new modern ways of doing business, and then you find the regulators coming up behind you and almost shattering and say, well, actually, you can't do that anymore. That rework, that repurposing and that lost cost, you know, that's a bit of a disincentive for people to innovate and step on that bleeding edge. I mean, that can't be good for anyone, right?
No, definitely not. I think certainly with European views on the algorithms and things like that, they are actually going to outlaw some uses in some places. And that, again, they have very good reasons for that, historical reasons for doing that. But in China, they're going very much the other way. They do want organizations to harness this kind of stuff for a very particular social good. And it, but as well, I think it's not clear to me as well that any of those regulators are talking to each other. There's no coordination. There's so many different ways that these things are being characterized that, yeah, any organization that wants to try and navigate through that thicket, take a big machete. It's going to take a lot of work to cut through all that and get it right, I think, sure.
But you're also, yeah, you're also in situations where you're trying to regulate things that were not designed to be regulated. I mean, cast your mind back to the big debates around net neutrality, for example. The people who, in quotes, govern and try and manage that behemoth that is the internet, you know, very much pushed back and said, you know, there was some paranoia around it. You know, why do we need this? You know, there's a commercial overtone here, and that's not what the internet was about. This is about, you know, free speech and blah, 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 blah. And you've got to deal with all of that as well. Sorry, Rich, I talked over you there.
No, that's fine. I mean, I was just going to say it might be a slightly unpopular view, but I'm starting to feel a bit sorry for the regulators around here, because especially if you look at some of the threats we're talking about. But, you know, let's take the one in particular on ransomware, the evolution of ransomware, right? And we're saying that's partially coming around because regulators and law enforcement are rightly trying to crack down on what is, you know, the biggest cyber threat right now. But, you know, what we're saying, that's going to have unforeseen consequences, and that's going to happen with, you know, in the spaces, yeah, like we've been talking about around AI, cyber, kind of cryptocurrencies as well, sorry. But yeah, particularly ransomware, you know, any kind of law enforcement is just going to push the threat off in a different, potentially more dangerous direction. So it's a kind of, it's always going to feel like a never-ending battle, right? There's, you're always going to be one step behind from a regulatory point of view.
Yeah, I think feeling sorry for them is quite going to be a divisive comment, and I'd love to see the feedback on that.
I know where
you're coming from with that. You know, because society looks to legislators to govern and control and manage, and if they're not doing that, they get disdain. If they overburden, or in some cases, and you see the Congress behaviour when they pull Zuckerberg and others into a room, you know, their lack of knowledge and understanding of what they're trying to regulate and legislate against is equally as dangerous. So, you know, challenges from all directions there, I think.
Yeah, I think, like, who'd be a regulator? Yeah. It's a difficult job. I think we can at least acknowledge that. But moving on. So the second theme we have is about technology choices diminishing control. That's the title we gave it. And this is very much to do with the, again, unintended consequences in some respects, about some very good technologies that organizations are starting to deploy for very good reasons. They're very potent type technologies. I use that word a lot. It's a favorite one of mine. And I think they do have good things, but as well, they bring with them some dangers, and that's what we try to acknowledge here. And again, I sort of, they can diminish that trust, because a lot of what they try to do is, certainly with regard low code and no code, it's moving that development effort outside the control of IT and InfoSec. And definitely there's a real consequence there, and you do definitely lose control. But again, it's the trust here that, you know, you can set up that good culture to get people to do the right things, and yet we find that technology regularly just catches organizations out again, doesn't it? The innovation just keeps coming.
There's a line between trust and control, right? And I've been particularly interested in the idea of you know, the cloud risk bubble bursting, this idea of a quasi hostage scenario. You know, when I was CISO in the financial services sector, one of the things I took a bit of comfort in, if that's the right word, is I had oversight of tin to tip. Everything was under our jurisdiction, from the tin we were running on to the networks, to the data centers, the applications, the users, the whole kit and caboodle. You move that stuff out into cloud, all right, and you move that stuff into third party services, some of that control is diminished, and you trust that they're going to do the right thing by you. Now, we just had a torrid time over the last couple of years, and organizations who were thinking about going hybrid, going cloud, you know, found themselves in difficulty because they were sat in that on-premise world, and we suddenly took all the soldiers, moved them outside of the castle. You know, that's so you can see the short-term benefits of leveraging that. But there is a degradation of control as a consequence. And what you start to do is you trust that the vendor or vendors are going to do the right thing by you. Now, when that trust is tested by outages, and we, you know, we tracked some of the notable outages over the course of the last 18 months, they're the same failure modes that we used to have when we had control. You know, poor change, bad configuration, fire, flood, blah, blah, blah. But your ability to do anything about that is gone. And what do you tell your CEO when you say, well, actually, I can't control that anymore. I'm at the mercy of somebody that I trusted would do the right thing by me. That's an awkward boardroom conversation.
For sure. Yeah, I think as well on the operational side, I think we've got colleague Paul Holland who's doing some work on those industrial control systems. And again, for very good reasons, a lot of remote management has been put in place around those, but even though they are hard to manage. But again, I think there's some hostages being made there because the activists, those highly motivated individuals are keen to exploit some of those links because, you know, that attack surface is definitely multiplied and people are getting desperate. And I think, unfortunately, that's one thing we did pick out in, as a theme in the report, is just that background of turmoil, social, political, environmental activism is just definitely going to be rumbling away in the background, and that's going to cause a lot of trouble for organizations.
Well, I mean, you can do a lot of damage with very little effort if you attack the digital sphere, and you know that's the crux of the activism threat. You know, if you start seeing organizations with digital sprawl bringing remote sites into the mix, that's your weaker link. That's, you know, the opportunities to exploit that are pretty significant, I guess. Yeah.
Richard, I was just going to ask you in terms of sort of technologies you've seen and innovations you come through, because I suppose, I mean, the upside of this is that these technologies are being used for good reasons. I mean, it's not like they're all bad. It's just that they have, you know, trailing edges and bleeding edges, and that's what organizations have to cope with.
Exactly. So obviously we were looking specifically at, you know, cloud and, you know, low code, no code, and for very good reason, business want to pick that up, you know, around agility, elasticity, you know, just able to spin up processes, you know, very quickly, and, you know, get new applications out. So there's very good reason from a business point of view you want to be able to move that quickly. But yeah, you think about these technologies, they inherently demand trust. You have to trust that they're going to work. And yeah, as Paul says, when they don't, when there's outages, or when, you know, some bad code slips into the low code, no code platform, there's kind of massive vulnerabilities there. So it's and it goes back to this point. You know, we have to be able to trust those things to be able to do business, but you can't. It gets to a point, you know, people, it's been interesting, especially talking about the big cloud vendors. You know, this has come up a lot in some of the work I've done around supply chain. You know, there's a bit of an argument around how far can you assure big suppliers, you know, the big tech vendors, big cloud service providers in particular, because they're the least likely to let you do things like audits and self-assessments. You know, you pretty much, and they're not going to change their terms and conditions when you want to work with them. So, you know, for some people, they'll say, actually, do you know what? In the end, we're not going to test those guys too much. We trust them. They've got the processes in place. And they largely do. They spend more on security than pretty much anyone else. And they know it's in their interest to do so. But that doesn't stop things going wrong. You know, nothing's ever 100% secure. You really just got to acknowledge that risk.
Yeah, because
do you not also think that there's an additional challenge there in the right to portability? So, you know, when you're running tin to tip, you know, you want to change data center provider, you've got the capacity to do that.
Yeah.
If you put all your eggs in one big cloud provider basket, they're not really that interested in portability. But, how do you leverage your consumer choice and freedom to move from A to B to C? You just can't, can you?
Well, they're actively, obviously, you know, it doesn't make sense for their business to let you do that as easily as possible because they want to lock you into the whole platform. So it's deliberately going that way. And you can see it's for them, it's a virtuous circle for businesses who want to be able to move. It's a bit of a vicious circle of, if you move away from one of those providers, you're likely to get locked into another, right?
Yeah.
Well, and that's the challenge that you have in low code. I mean, your nightmare scenario is always something that happens at the foundational level. So if you find your application, you know, a lot of its shadow technology, shadow applications are being developed on a low code, no code platform that you then can't move away from easily without destabilizing the whole organization. Or you have the dreaded low-level vulnerability. I mean, you're trusting those providers to be doing the right thing by you. But the minute they don't, the exposure is yours. You know, that risk is yours. I don't know, Mark. I know you've looked at that quite extensively in terms of low-code, no-code. I don't know what your thoughts are.
Yeah, I think at the moment, certainly, there's a lot of no-code, low-code platforms out there. And I suspect we're in that expansion and we'll soon be in the contraction phase. And then a lot of organizations will be caught out because suddenly a lot of the stuff that they used will disappear or will be acquired or no longer supported. And suddenly, I think it'll be obvious that there are big chunks of their organizations being run by aspect, sorry, third parties out there they just did not know about and now have no control over, and the assets are gone. So I think, yeah, we're in a difficult phase there for sure. And certainly by 2024, I mean, there's all kinds of estimates about how many, how much code is going to be written beyond IT departments or beyond development methodologies, and it's, you know, it's a scary amount for sure. Anyhow,
so just on that, we were talking a couple of days ago about I can't remember when this conversation was, but hear me out. A friend of mine in the industry kind of dropped a hypothetical question about DevSecOps and said, if DevSecOps gets really, really robust and strong, why do you need centralized security teams? And it kind of got me thinking about the conversations we were having around low code and no code. It almost feels like you're always going to need that independent internal arbitrator just to make sure that you've got that balance between kind of trust and assurance absolutely tip top. I don't know if you guys have got any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think there's always going to be a need for that good practice and, you know, showing the way in some respects, because I think developers, you know, for all their skills and all the good that they do, I think sometimes they need a bit of direction. And I think as well, some of the newer tools, the AI tools, again, are very strong, very useful, and developers doubtless will adopt them and use them because they'll speed things up for them and solve some of those tricky coding problems. But again, you're handing your control over to something. So you need to set some boundaries and some rules. And I think that's always going to be something you can only do out beyond those developer groups or, you know, functions within organizations. Yeah, I think it needs that oversight.
Yeah, because I mean, maybe in an ideal world or an ideal future world, you wouldn't need that central IT or InfoSec function, because everyone else has it built into their processes, into their mindset, thinks about, you know, considers it, all the developers will consider it during that time. At the moment, probably a good place to be is for an InfoSec team to be that kind of arbiter and promoter and champion of good practice, I guess, because you're not going to be able to, you know, generally in the real world, the budget and the size of the team is, you don't have a view over everything that everyone is doing. Sure. But kind of setting that good practice and providing some oversight is going to be
a key task. It's definitely a conversation that I'd be interested in having with members going forward. I mean, not really one for now, but if you've got any thoughts on that, you know, what you think the future of centralized versus decentralized security teams are, why not drop a comment, isflive.org, and, you know, we can have the conversation there. I think it would be interesting to float that topic, but yeah. I don't want to digress from a threat horizon, Mark, so let's come back to topic.
Yeah, let's dive into that third theme, dirty data disrupts business. And this very much felt like the foundational problem for the whole report, really, just that you can no longer trust the data you get and use for your organization, call it lifeblood, call it, you know, the oil that you use, the plutonium that powers your, you know, the reactor of your enterprise or something like that, however you want to characterize it. But data is fundamental to what organizations do. And I think it's our contention that you just can't trust it anymore. Where's it coming from? Who's giving it to you? Or, well, is it pure? Does it have integrity? All those knotty issues definitely are coming to a pinch point.
I'm getting you a t-shirt, mate. It's going to say data is life. You just have asking me, data is, I'm just seeing you now with chief data officers around you going, I've seen the light. Data is life.
Well, I think, I mean, certainly, We have had that conversation about organizations being afloat on a sea of data, and they have to pilot and navigate their way, and the seas are shifting, and it's sometimes there's very big waves, and, you know, like I say, however you characterize it, but it's right there in everything that organizations do.
I mean, I find this topic absolutely fascinating, and we could talk about this for hours, and maybe one of the, when we do the deeper dives, we can go into this in a bit more detail. But I kind of come back to the traditional you know, tenets of information and cybersecurity. We talk about confidentiality, integrity, and availability. And we've had this obsession to worry about availability and confidentiality. And we've had many notable examples of, you know, why that's important to us. But I think integrity becomes the new battleground, right? I mean, if you've got so much data flying past you at such a rate of speed that you can't assure it, and you're just trusting that that data is giving you the right answers, integrity, I mean, that's got to be the new battleground. And I don't think, or I don't necessarily believe, that all organizations have invested the time they need, certainly in unstructured data, to have the right methods of assurance when they're consuming that data, you know, be it their data or data they're sourcing from a third or fourth party. You know, you want to poison that data. Well, there's nothing in place to say, hang on a minute, this data is not telling me what I expect it to tell me. I smell a rat. You just consume that data. You take it for granted. Garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah, and that's only going to get more important when we think over the coming years and what the technology is that's going to drive business forward, drive innovation and processes. It, you know, AI, machine learning, whatever you want to call it, it all relies on good data. You know, if you want to get any decent kind of output from this new tech, you need to have very good, very clean, yeah, just accurate data. And I mean, yeah, and it's used so quickly. There's, yeah, what chance do you have of providing assurance over it? I think there was a stat we were talking about the other day, Paul. You said, is it something like 30% of the data that's being created at the moment is used instantly?
Correct.
Yeah. I mean, and that's incredible when you think about it. There's how do you, we're going to have to try and work towards a point where you can assure things, assure data in real time. It's almost kind of like, you know, real time fact checking. Yeah. At a micro level. Yeah.
Well, I think with all the work on machine learning, what that's taught us is that data is not neutral. And you really do have to consult, you know, its sources and where it's coming from. And obviously we've got in the background to all this, you know, whenever you go on any web page these days, just, you know, you can scare yourself to death by looking at how many cookies, how many trackers are there, what are they looking for? The journey that you take through a website is absolute gold mine. And that all that information is being gathered, it's being sold off, and there's a vast chunk of, you know, that data economy exists because of that. So it's clearly very important, valuable stuff, but it's not neutral for sure. I think that, and that's where the regulators step in again. They've realized that you know, the uses to which it can be put are sometimes good, but often bad, and blindly bad, in that the organizations don't realize what that data, whether it's taking them for sure.
But it's interesting. It kind of takes me back to the conversation we were just having about regulations. So, you know, interesting. I use my family as a bit of a test bed, which they hate. But now that's what you get for living with a security professional. But what I found really, really interesting is they never really understood what cookies are, were, what do they do, what do they not do, what's their relevance to me. And the legislations then kind of kept up or caught up. And it now says, you want to put a cookie on someone's machine, you've got to tell them what it's there for, why it's going to do, you know, and you're starting to see that friction hitting UX. And you know, my wife and my kids get really annoyed with that. And they go, well, cookie choices, well, I hit the green accept button because I want to get on and do what I do. So, you know, regulatory compliance, we're ticking the boxes, we're giving the people the choice, but we're using the friction almost as an enticement to ignore what we're telling them. Surely that can't be right. And again, you know, opportunities to misinform and misdirect by using, you know, that friction and driving that friction against the impatience of society now. You know, I find that quite interesting as well. You've got to have this balance between caveat emptor and having a fluid experience online. And if you get that wrong, then, you know, people will go and use your competitor's website. It's a tightrope to walk, I think.
Yeah, I think so. Certainly with, I know, again, in Europe, there are big pushes now to really clamp down on the amount of personal data that's being gathered. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Certainly Facebook has suffered because of Apple's move to limit that tracking. Their share price is severely dented as a result of some of that. So again, I mean, that proves the value of this stuff. If you can wipe 20% off Facebook's share price, then yeah, that's valuable stuff that clearly that they're stopping getting. But I think as well, I mean, as someone who tried in vain many times to preserve their privacy, I've not quite given up, but you know, I do what I can. And I think that's part of the problem here is just my data is not really my data anymore. It's data about me that other people want, and you know, that they get it in many different ways, then it's impossible for me to navigate that.
Now, just going back to something Richard said, you know, he was right in, you know, 30% of this data is being consumed in real time. What I found quite striking in the research I did, and IDC, I think, quoted this number that 90 zettabytes of that 175 zettabytes of data by 2025 will be being created and or consumed by Internet of Things devices. You know, this is a largely newer phenomena. So you're talking about a sprawl of, you know, non-computer devices, dare I say that, the concept of Internet of Things. And they're slurping that data, they're spewing that data out, and they're doing that in real time. And if you think about how we then consume that data and react to it, and we talk about cyber fusion centers, and we talk about digital twins, the opportunity to just manipulate that data to, and, you know, back to that concept of control, to get people to dance the way you want them to dance, you know, that absolutely fractures the trust model. I know digital twins was a particular favorite of yours, Mark. And, you know, I don't know, thoughts on where we're going with digital twins. I mean, we can't not trust industrial control systems.
I did like that because it's a bit science fictional, because it's has that those connections between the end product. I think one of the examples we used was a car maker, and they have real-time data being fed back from the cars to the digital twin, so you can model it before you put it into production and improve, you know, get that virtuous circle of gradual improvement to the whatever you're making. But I think, I mean, just to sort of try and round off some of this, because we are painting a bit of a bleak picture here. You know, it's sort of dirty data, is unintended consequences, there's technology that's outrunning your controls and organizations in peril in some respects. But is it all bad, Richard? Should we throw up our hands in despair and give up now? Or is there, you know, what is there a way out of this? Big question.
Well, very much, yeah, talking to InfoSec professionals, we don't tend to be the most positive bunch.
What are you saying?
I don't know, Paul. to be honest, I don't know if we had the answer. We'd surely say, but yeah, I mean, we asked the question right at the end of the report, you know, where do we go now? And I think we use the phrase tipping point in the 2023 report, so I don't want to talk about that again necessarily. But you know, there's this, as ever, you know, the future's not written. This could go at least one of two ways. You know, but I think there's a decision to make from not just InfoSec professionals, but you know, kind of business leaders as well. Do we give up on this concept of trust? Do we now have to start applying something like zero trust to every walk of life, you know, let alone, you know, as your key security principle. But also, you know, I think we've got to start thinking, how do we start to rebuild that as well? So how can we actually start to gain more trust? Is, you know, if we can build security into the IoT from the ground up, for instance, does that start to help? Because, you know, suddenly you're able to trust the data that's coming from these connected devices everywhere. So yeah, there's lots of work to do, I think, if we're going to go that way. But yeah, it's a legitimate choice to make, and I don't have the answer.
No, but I think, like you say, asking the question, isn't it? And I think there is some real work to do in that the future is not set, and there are zero trust and other methods can be found to try and get some trust back, or at least reassure yourself that things are going in the right direction. But I think as well, there is the excitement of this is that organizations have become much more dynamic, and the way they're going and the way they're working takes skill, and it's a bit of a white knuckle ride sometimes, but I think being part of that, I mean, that's again some of the attraction of being involved in this kind of stuff, isn't it? So that's why you do it. You know, that's not Serena Williams does not play tennis just so she can win every time. She wants to be challenged, and I think for InfoSec folks, that's part of why they do it, isn't it? Paul, is that why you did it? Because you like to be like problems to solve? And
no, it turns out I came into InfoSec because I'm a moody git, which I will be reminding Richard of on a regular basis.
I knew it.
But no, I mean, all seriousness, you know, trust has a part to play. But I think when you think about it in the concept of risk and threat management, I think you now have to have clear markers where you are making the conscious decision to trust. And you need to constantly remind yourself that you are taking for granted the integrity of inputs that you are consuming to elicit output. And it's as simple as that. You know, we talked about last year, this reaching a bit of a tipping point. I think by 2024 on current projections, you know, that control is completely lost, and trust is basically, you know, a big part of our lives, and the opportunity for exploitation is great. I think the time is now for organizations to selectively choose where they want to put trust in place, and where they believe the price or the cost is too high, then zero trust architectures and that sort of method of never trust but verify through people, process and technology has to be a part of enterprise. But it's a constantly moving feast, and it's constantly dynamic. We have to get the balance right to continue to be highly innovative, highly agile business and enterprise without tripping over our shoelaces in the process. It's what we've said time and time and time again when we talk about risk management. Shift the conversations to the left, go into and making those decisions, do it with your eyes wide open, and know where you want to trust and accept, and know where you want to verify, comply and assure, and just get that balance right. I think there is still opportunity to make the best of both worlds.
Thank you. Thanks, Paul. Thanks, Richard. And thank you to everyone for listening. You can find more podcasts on the ISF podcast channel or at securityforum.org, where you can also learn more about ISF research tools and guidance.